It's Easy to Remember with McCoy Tyner on piano from the John Coltrane Ballads album, and McCoy Tyner will be with us in just a moment. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by the three authors of Still Philadelphia, a photographic history from 1890 to 1940, focusing on the city's industrial and ethnic neighborhoods. The authors, Frederick Miller, Morris Vogel, and Alan Davis, write with pride that there are no photographs of official Philadelphia in their book. No Independence Hall, no mummers' parades, mayors, or scenes from the Sesquicentennial. More at about 4 o'clock. At 3:40, WHYY's City Hall reporter Tia O'Brien will speak with John Max, the political director for Frank Rizzo's unsuccessful mayoral campaign. They'll discuss the strategy behind the Rizzo campaign and why it failed. The Cool Jazz Festival will return for its second summer in Philadelphia from June 4th through 14th. With me is McCoy Tyner, who will perform at one Cool concert and attend another presented in his honor. Violinist John Blake, who has played with Tyner's band, will lead a tribute to Tyner on Monday, June 6th at the Chestnut Cabaret. And Tyner will perform with Archie Shepp Friday, June 10th at the New Tech Uptown Theater on Broad Street. Pianist and composer McCoy Tyner grew up in Philadelphia, in the same West Philadelphia neighborhood as Bud Powell. In 1959, he joined a band led by Art Farmer and Benny Golson, which he left later that year to become John Coltrane's pianist. The next 5 or 6 years, they recorded about 20 albums together. Since he left Coltrane in 65, he's performed and recorded under his own name. He's recorded for Milestone Records since 1972. You can hear Tyner's influence in many players who grew up listening to and emulating his records. Before we talk, I'd like to play a selection from one of his recent records. From the album Passion Dance, this is McCoy Tyner at the piano playing John Coltrane's The Promise. McCoy Tyner recorded in concert in Japan in 1978 from the album Passion Dance, that was The Promise. McCoy Tyner will be saluted on Monday, June 6th as part of the Cool Jazz Festival in a concert at the Chestnut Cabaret on 38th and Chestnut Streets under the direction of John Blake. And then Friday, June 10th, McCoy Tyner will be playing with tenor saxophonist Archie Shepp at 8 o'clock at the New Tech Uptown Theater. McCoy Tyner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
To have you here.
My pleasure.
You'll be playing at the New Tech Theater in a few weeks. This won't be the first time you've played there, will it? Maybe
no.
The first time is the new theater.
Yeah, right. At the time, it was just the Uptown Theater. When I was a teenager in Philadelphia, they used to have talent shows on Saturday up there, and I had like a seven-piece band of high school students, you know, guys who were my friends that played instruments, and I put this band together, and we used to, you know, play a few house parties and a few gigs, and that was one of the places that we happened to win one of the talent shows on one of those Saturdays.
Do you remember?
I'll never forget that.
Do you remember what you played?
Yeah. We won it by playing. At that time, it was a trombonist called Benny Green. It was pretty popular, and Benny had a tune called "Blow Your Horn," and the trombonist Donald Keith, who at that time, he memorized a solo, and that's what got us over. That was the one. That's how we won that show. You know.
Was jazz the first music that you listened to?
No, actually, it was blues and what we call at the time, it was like house rock. That's what they call it. You know, R&B and house rock. And then later on I listened to bebop. You know, bebop is really what I came up on. I mean, after I went through that phase of having a rhythm and blues band, and then we went right to bebop. You know, of course, before that I studied a little bit of the European classics. You know, as when I first started playing piano. You know, so I had a pretty wide range of influences, and I think a pretty good background. I mean, in terms of exposure. You know,
who introduced you to jazz?
Well. It wasn't any one particular person, actually. I think that it was just around my neighborhood, which was West Philly, there were a lot of musicians around the neighborhood that played music and played jazz, I should say. And they sort of, you know, I mean, they sort of like took me under their wing and you know, tried to help me and they tried to influence the young people. You know, they like to see you live a nice, clean life and play. You know, and even their lives were different, but they wanted to see you get ahead. And they really, if they saw talent, they really tried to help you.
What kind of advice were you given?
Well, actually, we had a lot of places to play. We had there was a place here called Rittenhouse Hall. We used to go there and play a lot. You know, and we have dances on the weekend, and we would have sessions in each other's houses, and we were just encouraged to play as much as possible, you know, and to practice. That was very normal here in Philadelphia. I mean, the jazz scene here was very, very vibrant, very active, you know, and if there wasn't a session in North Philly, it was one in South Philly. If there wasn't one in South Philly, it was one in West Philly, and that type of thing. So it was like a lot of activity, and so that's why we had such an array of great musicians coming out of Philly. You know, if you look back historically, you can see where it just the numbers just keep coming, you know, just so many people. You know.
I know in the neighborhood I grew up in Brooklyn, if a boy was learning how to play piano, especially if it was classical music, he was really considered a sissy. And I don't know if anybody ever laid that kind of trip on you, especially when you were studying classical music or not.
Not really, because I never really... I wasn't too much a part of the, you know, the gang scene or anything like that. I mean, I had friends in the neighborhood, and you know, and we sometimes had different interests. But people seemed to, in my neighborhood, seemed to like music. A lot of my peers, you know, they seemed to like music, and they were into like the heroes of music. You know, heroes of jazz. Like when Charlie Parker died, I mean, it was really a big thing. I mean, like guys were crying on the street. I mean, you know, it was just that. That kind of identification, you know. So I never, the only thing that used to happen sometimes, I'd be in my mother's shop, you know, because my mother's a beautician, and I'd be in the shop and we'd be playing. And some people would walk by and say, well, make a request, and you had to honor it, else you couldn't come outside, that type of thing. But it, other than that, I really didn't run into too much of that, you know, and the people saying you know. Because actually, I found that there was a lot of respect for the musician in the community, really.
Can you hear a continuation in the music of the people who you grew up with in Philadelphia who've since become, like yourself, well-known?
Yeah, I mean a continual growth, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, can you listen to their music now and hear it when you think back of what they were playing when you played together when you were coming up?
Yeah, I can. I think that basically their characteristics musically haven't changed that much, but I think that I could hear it in the embryo stage, you know, and the sound is still there, you know.
When you first joined John Coltrane, did you have any idea what that was going to be like? Did you have a preconception of what it would mean for you?
Yeah, because I actually joined John. I mean, I actually met John about 3 years before I actually joined his band, you know. So I was about 17 when I met John here. And we used to talk a lot, you know. And he was just an interim because he went back with Miles in the late 50s. But this was the mid-50s when I met him. And we used to talk quite a bit. We got to be quite friendly, as a matter of fact. And he's sort of like a big brother to me, you know, and we used to talk a lot about music. And so when he got his group, it was just an automatic thing that, you know, that I would be the pianist. I mean, he wanted me to play with him, you know, so and I was honored to be associated with him, you know.
Was that when you first left Philadelphia?
Well, when I first left Philly, I really worked with the jazz tat, you know, with Art Farmer, Benny Golson, Curtis Fuller, and Addison Farmer, Dave Bailey were musicians in the jazz tat. I left Philadelphia with a job, and I was working with them. And I stayed with them about 6 months and then consequently joined John afterwards, which I had made a sort of a previous commitment.
How did you know when it was time to leave Philadelphia?
Well, I think I was, like, working in the daytime and playing at night, and I got to be pretty good around here. And I used to get a lot of the good gigs that came through Philly, with various people, if they would come in as singles, and you know, and some singers that would come in, and I would work with them, and I just had to decide whether I was going to stay here and try to do both things, or just leave Philadelphia and go to New York. I think your decision has to be made by the individual. When you know, you have to know. I mean, you can tell a person to leave town and go to New York, but they have to actually decide it that themselves.
When you were playing with Coltrane and doing some of the free sessions, did you see that as being a break with the past or a continuation from the past, like a logical extension of what had happened?
Yeah, it was a logical extension of what was happening in that band. I think that the band moved at such a rapid pace in terms of growth, and sometimes I'd wonder, I said, wow, we were there 3 months ago, now we're here, you know. So it's the band is it was constantly growing, and sometimes it would just be amazing. And so everything was like based on what had happened before, you know. And I guess it was for that band, it was a very logical, step to take. You know, sometimes it, and I would wonder, you know, where we were going, you know, but I just try to follow what was happening and, you know, stay abreast of what was going on in the band, you know, so that I could contribute to the music.
I want to play a passage from the Ascension record. Could you tell us a little bit about how the session was formed and what kind of organization there was beforehand?
I'm trying to think who were the guests on that particular record. I don't know if I think it was just the band or did we have other people? I think we had
Archie Shapp and
yeah,
Pharoah
right.
Sanders.
Yeah. I think at that time it was, John was experimenting with how should I put it, sound, you know, and what I mean, like sort of a complex sound, like multi-textured sound, you know, rather than just he was trying to embellish on the sound that the group had developed, you know, and I think he wanted to embellish on that and make it more, add more textures. And I think by adding more voices, you know, he would get the thickness and that he wanted, you know. I really don't know. I mean, this is just my summation. You know, he was that type of person. I think he always liked to experiment with things. I think that he liked to try things. He wasn't afraid to try things, you know. And I think that there's a lesson in that, I guess, you know, that you have to give things a try and see how it works out. But he was constantly doing that, you know, throughout most of his career, you know, trying different things, and you know.
Do you remember how he spelled out the structure?
Well, actually, it wasn't any spelling out on this. I mean, most of the time when we reached up, when we reached this particular project, prior to this, we would sometimes he would bring in scales. Like at, I remember one time we were like fooling around with ragas, Indian ragas, you know, and there wasn't a specific chordal structure, so it would be based basically on scales. You know, and that's why you could move. I could move harmonically any place. I mean, you just had to be very receptive to what was happening on stage, you know, and move wherever the movement was taking place. And this was sort of a development from that concept, you know, rather than chords, but sound and movement. You know, I think that's really what this was about.
Well, let's hear just a passage from the Ascension record, which was a free session, and I think the recording really changed a lot of people's thinking when it came out. Let's listen to a passage from it, and then we'll talk about it some more.
All right. Oh,
passage from the 1965 John Coltrane session, Ascension, with my guest McCoy Tyner on piano. What was the role of the pianist becoming in a session like that, where there's a lot of emphasis on free blowing, and you were, you know, of course a soloist, but also you were in the position of being like a rhythm section for something that was escaping from the traditions and standards of jazz.
Well, the whole thing in that particular concept of playing, which was a natural, I think, step that the group took because of where it had come from. You know, I mean, if you notice chronologically, like the group has progressed step by step from one phase to another, you know, in its development. And I think that the reason why I think my playing in that band was had some significance as much as it did, it was because of the fact that I kept motion, you know, especially in this particular type of playing, that you had to move. You know, John liked, you know, motion is, you know, whatever motion you can make, fine. And sometimes I would even, it was more like a tone center that was established, and then we work around that, you know. We could move just about where you want it, as you know, and just had to really be receptive as to what, you know. So for some reason, a path would clear itself. You know, say, oh yeah, that's where we'll go. You know, it's hard to predict what it would be, but some kind of way, a direction would be formed. You know,
were there problems that you as a pianist had that the horn players wouldn't have in sessions like this?
Not really, because of the way I played in a band. I didn't have any basic problems. It was just I moved according to whatever the sound was at that time. You know, I mean, in other words, at that moment, that's really what it was, from moment to moment. You know, and that playing can be interesting in many ways if you have people that have been playing together and are very, very in tune with each other, and then you can really move emotionally together and really be receptive. But, just get a bunch of guys together and say, okay, let's do something like that. I mean, you know, to me, like I said, it's greatest when it can be done, like, you know, when people know each other musically.
Yeah. What kind of comments have you gotten from people for whom this session and your other work with Coltrane is like really important for in their own musical development or listening development?
People really revere the group in many respects. I know when Elvin and I did something together last summer, we did a collaboration thing and came together and we played in Paris, and it was like so many people, it was unbelievable. We played at a club called the New Morning Club in Paris, and they loved it. I mean, you know, it's like, I think nostalgia is great, but I'm just the type of artist that I like to do. I like to move on, you know, to the next step for me. You know, I'm not totally submerged in nostalgia. And I think it's important if you're alive to keep trying to move ahead and do some different things.
I thought choices in the Coltrane repertoire, like My Favorite Things and Chim Chimney, were astoundingly corny. I couldn't, you know, just knowing that was recorded, of course, hearing it, you'd get a different impression of it. But were you surprised when those were selected?
Yeah, well, My Favorite Things, at first I heard it. It was like a very popular, because I think the Sound of Music was a very popular, by Hammerstein, was a very popular musical. I was on Broadway, I think, at that time, you know. And, I thought that at first it was a little corny, but then after John came over to my house and he kind of explained how he wanted it done, then it made a lot of sense. And at first, even when I first played it, I said, well, yeah, right, it sounds interesting. But then it began to develop and it took many shapes and became a very strong piece. So I later on I realized the real significance of that song, you know.
When you left the Coltrane band, were you doing anything to consciously develop your style outside of it?
Well, all the while I was with him, I was recording on my own, and I had a pretty extended recording career, you know, parallel to some of the things I was doing with him, you know.
How would you describe yourself as a band leader?
Well, I was a good follower. I was a good side man. I think that's what it takes. This is one of the comments that I like to make about doing your apprenticeship. I think that during the time I was coming up, there were many bands that you could play with, and you could graduate from one band to the other, and you learn from each band, you know, and each band was like going to a new school, you know. And now you don't see that as much. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but you just don't see it as much, you know. And you had really golden opportunities to learn from these masters and learn from these people. And I think it's very important, you know. I really do.
Some of the musicians who play with you are pretty young, and they're really learning through being in your band. Do you find yourself taking on an almost paternal role in that band and in guiding the young musicians?
In a sense, but, you know, I've learned, I think I used to be more like that than I am now. I've learned that, you know, they look to you for guidance to an extent because of the fact that I've been around for a while and I've been in some pretty interesting musical settings. So I've learned a little something along the way. But, yeah, so they look to you. You have to really be more than just a leader. I think it's a matter of being a man as well. You know, you're not on the stage all the time, so it's a combination of both things, trying to balance yourself as an artist and as a band.
So you have to set an example.
Somewhat an example. I mean, I don't mean to perfection, but I mean, you know. But I think the role of leadership is a responsibility. You know?
What will you do with a soloist who gets carried away with their own playing and goes on maybe past the point where they have something to say?
Well, then, of course, you can always pull a person like that aside, you know, and not embarrassingly, but, you know, in at a time that it's makes sense. And, you know, we can talk about music. I mean, we talk about it. I mean, you know, it's like I discuss certain things with the guys in the band just so that we can get an understanding of where I may think it should be, the way I think it should be, and also the way and have them interject their ideas so that we can get a nice balance there, you know, of information and hopefully input. You know, I don't want to be just the only person saying something. I mean, I think I like to listen. That's why I try to keep young people in the band so that it can be inspirational to all of us. You know,
do you talk with the soloist beforehand about like how long a solo should be or what kind of shape it should have within a piece?
Yeah, sometimes that comes up, but I don't talk. I mean, the only time, like some songs have, they shouldn't. Like I'm very conscious of length because, of course, when I was with John, I mean, like some songs would be like an hour and a half or something. You know, and so right now I try to do things within a reasonable amount of time. Try to make a statement, a musical statement, and I may mention it on occasion. And well, I like to sneak this tune in, and we've only got 15-20 minutes. Let's do this, and you know we only got like a half an hour to do this, and just to balance the set out rather than have one song going forever. You know, like it's more interesting. You know,
McCoy Tyner is my guest. If you're just joining us, and he'll be performing at the Cool Joust Festival on Friday, June 10th, and there will also be on Monday, June 6th, a concert saluting him, and I'll tell you a little more about that in a couple of minutes. Your playing can be heard in the playing of many younger pianists who were very influenced by your work and who continue to be very influenced by your work. How do you feel when you're listening either on record or in performance to someone who's obviously spent a lot of time listening to your solos?
Well, I feel very thankful that that I have a voice in music. I think that that's very, very important above many things, you know, to be able to contribute a sound or your sound to music from a historical point of view, to be able to say, well, like, yeah, I did contribute something, I did add something. And I think that if musicians feel like, young pianists feel like that they can learn something that way, I feel very honored. I really do. And I feel very blessed to be in a position to be able to contribute.
There are days when you don't feel like playing and you wish you didn't have to do that concert.
Yeah, well, Not really. I think what happens with right now in my life, I think music is becoming very, very important to me, even more as I get older, because I realize that it's such a uplifting thing. I mean, because it divorces you from a lot of the everyday nuisances or things that you have to deal with that you may not want to. And I think it really does a lot to kind of motivate you to go on and face that day, even though you may run into a little adversity along the way.
Does music do that for you?
Yes, it does. It really does it for me, because when I'm playing it, I'm just into the music. I mean, I'm not in such a great feeling, and it helps me to deal with the other things that I have to deal with in life.
How much playing do you do at home when it's not tied in with the performance?
Well, right now, not a lot. You know, at one time in my life, I used to practice almost every day, you know. But this is when I was very young. I had a really good practice schedule going. But as I got older and I was playing a lot, I really didn't need to practice as much because I was playing almost every night. But even though I'm playing a lot now, I still feel the need to sit down during the day. I just started another practice schedule. You know, I want to do some things that I've been hearing, and I really don't have to practice it. It's just a matter of spending time at the piano, that's all.
What do you listen to on the radio when you're in the car?
Well, I have some tapes sometimes. I'll listen to some different things. But I listen to a variety of music rather than just one type of music. You know, I like to listen to music from different parts of the world and that type of thing. I don't have any specific thing that I listen to, really.
You're going to be playing on Friday, June 10th with Archie Shepp, who also spent many years in Philadelphia. Are there still connections between the people who came up together in this city, musicians?
Yeah, I think that, yes, there's still connections. I think that in the 60s, of course, the connections were very strong because we had so many, like, say, for instance, Lee Morgan and I used to play a lot together, and Archie and Reggie Workman, and, you know, there were many others that, you know, of course, Tootie Heath from the Heath Brothers, and that we used to play a lot together. I mean, there were a lot of musicians, but in the 60s, we sort of like, if we didn't come at the same time in New York, we sort of, there were maybe as a matter of a few years, you know, in terms of, you know, everybody coming to New York. In other words, one guy would come a year, next guy would come the next year or the following year, and that type of thing. So we sort of kind of like, we were close to each other because we kind of knew each other, you know, from being in Philly, you know. So even though we would, like Lee was with Dizzy's band, Big Band, and then he was with Blakey for a while, and I would see him, and sometimes we'd do record dates together and that type of thing. So, there was a fraternal feeling between us, you know. I don't see Archie that much. I don't see, because everybody's schedule is so different, and he spends a lot of time in Europe, and I think he lives in Massachusetts, and I live somewhere else, so... we don't see each other that much, but you know, now and then I'll see Kenny Barron, or, you know, was another great piano player from Philly, and some of the other musicians, you know, periodically.
Do you know what you'll be playing that Friday night?
What I'll be playing?
With Archie Shepp.
You mean some of the compositions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll probably do a mixture of some of the newer things that I've been doing, like Island Birdie and Hannibal, and also do some things like I'll go back and do It's Easy to Remember, you know, Coltrane Days, and I'll do some variety of things, just a mixture.
Okay, we'll be hearing one of the pieces you just mentioned, Island Birdie, in just a minute. But before we hear it, I want to remind our listeners of the Cool Jazz Festival, which is coming up June 4th through 14th. And McCoy Tyner and Archie Shepp will be playing on June 10th at the New Tech Uptown Theater on Broad Street. And there will also be a salute to McCoy Tyner. And proceeds from this will go towards the establishment of a McCoy Tyner Scholarship Fund. And this special cool jazz concert will be happening Monday evening, June 6th at 7:30. It will be at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets, co-sponsored by the Jazz Society of Philadelphia and the Cool Jazz Festival and the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. So that's Monday evening, June 6th. At 7:30, and by the way, violinist John Blake, who has played with McCoy Tyner, will be there. Kenny Barron will be there, and it will be a McCoy Tyner alumni band. So for more information, you can call 876-0761. That's 876-0761. And we're going to listen to a selection from your most recent album, which is called Looking Out, and it will be Island Birdie, the piece that you just mentioned. Do you want to say a few words about this album and what the concept of the album was?
Well, it's really a departure from what I'm normally associated with in terms of jazz. But it was a new venture for me and something that I really wanted to do, sort of a marriage of concepts or a marriage of people from different musical idioms, like Carlos Santana was on, and he was more or less a rock guitar player, but a good friend of mine, and I, you know, thought it'd be nice to use him on this, and then Phyllis Hyman, of course, you know, who's she sings jazz as well as pop things, so it was an interesting thing from a production point of view too, you know, so I kind of liked it. Some people, you know, it stirred up a little controversy, but I liked it a lot.
Did it reach different listeners than your other albums?
Yeah, I think so. Judging from the audiences that I've had, it reached some different people, yeah.
Was that part of the intention to reach a larger audience?
Yeah, part of it was that. And I think part of it was just that I do things like this sometimes. You know, I'll go off and do some things that aren't necessarily normal, you know, what quote-unquote people, you know, would relate to me, and I just do that because I like to keep things interesting, you know. I like to do some different things, and I like to expand on my audience, yeah. But I mean, not at necessarily expense of doing, you know, commercial things, because for like my next project will be totally different from what I just did with.
Do you know what it'll be?
Well, it's I'd rather not talk about it right now, but it'll be more straight
right.
ahead type of things, you know. Some younger musicians on the horizon, you know.
Great. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for doing this interview, and I look forward to hearing you at the Cool Festival. And congratulations on being saluted by the city of Philadelphia.
Yeah,
it's
well,
great.
Believe me, it's my pleasure. You know, you can travel around the world, but when you get have someone at home give you a tribute, it really means more. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Yeah. Pianist and composer McCoy Tyner has been my guest. Let's listen to Island Birdie, a selection from his most recent album, which is called Looking Out. Thank you. Island Birdie from the most recent McCoy Tyner record called Looking Out. And pianist and composer McCoy Tyner will be playing with Archie Shepp on Friday, June 10th at the New Tech Uptown Theater on Broad Street as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. And there will be a salute to McCoy Tyner, featuring a McCoy Tyner alumni band led by John Blake, on Monday, June 6th at the Chestnut Cabaret on 38th and Chestnut Streets. It's 8 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in a half hour, we'll be hearing from Frederick Miller, Morris Vogel, and Alan Davis, the three co-authors of a new book called Still Philadelphia, a photographic history of Philadelphia from 1890 through 1940, focusing on the ethnic and industrial neighborhoods of the city. Last week, after the primaries, WHYY's City Hall reporter Tia O'Brien spoke with one of Frank Rizzo's four top aides, John Max. Coming up, we're going to hear that interview. John Max served as the Rizzo campaign's political director and played a major role.